Hi, and welcome to Doing the Opposite, Business Disruptors. I'm really, really excited about my guest today, David Phil. David had a career trajectory unlike any in the history of music. In 79, he and his band The Automatic scored a number one hit in their native England with a punk anthem, When the Tanks Roll Over Poland Again. Their recording label then had a change of management and The Automatics were left high and dry. David moved to LA to try and kickstart his career to no avail. But in 2002, he got a call from Japan, and that's when it all changed. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Jeff. It's good to be here.
So, David, what I'm really fascinated by, and what I'm sure the audience will be fascinated by, is can you give me some examples of how you have done the opposite or changed the game or been disruptive in your life or career? You know, can you give us sort of a story or two about how that's, you know, where that's happened in your life?
Yes. The first one I would think was 1983, and I leave London and I come to California. And the circumstances around that were actually quite haphazard, because when I left, you know, I packed a suitcase, figured I'd be gone for 10 days, and I never went back to my life in London. That was a passive decision, and it went something like this. I was in the wild and wacky world of rock and roll, and there was this very charming English woman that I'd known for a long time. One night she called me up at about 2 o'clock in the morning and said, "Darling, you got any booze?" Because, yeah, this is 1983, and, you know, after the off licenses closed at 9 and the pubs closed at 10:30, you were screwed. So I said, "Well, yes, actually, I do." And she said, "Because I've got this Californian heiress round here, so I'll send a car for you." So get in the car, and I come over, and we spend a very pleasant evening. A few days later, the heiress turns up on my doorstep, and we go out and we go to a Bowie concert. And then she starts sending me tickets to come to California. You know, so nothing's really working very well for me in London. So, you know, one day I take it. Like I said, I had no plans on emigrating to America, but I went there. And after I'd been there about, it was all kind of fun, and she was making a big fuss of me, and we were driving around in limos, and all that was fairly charming. And
living the dream.
Well, that's what I thought at the time, you know. But then, due to the wonders of British dentistry and the violence of punk, I had a tooth knocked out at the front and had been replaced by a British dentist, and immediately fell out again. So I went to the American dentist, and he said, "Well, yeah, I can fix it. It'll be like $900 or something," which is probably as much as I had in my back pocket at the time. So I said, "Well, I'm going to go back to England and I'll get it fixed on the National Health." And the heiress looked at me and she said, "You know, if we were married, I could get that tooth fixed for free on my insurance." And that was marriage number two. We've skipped over marriage number one, but because that's how I came to America. It was more or less a happenstance, passive decision. And then I spent the next 4 years on a rampage.
Well, I've heard some great reasons for getting married, but I think that tops the lot, really.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. It was pretty insane. But the whole thing was pretty insane, you know. A few years after that, you know, I kind of got the message that it was time to grow up and start taking things more seriously. And that, you know, I wasn't going to have the kind of music career that I had hoped, you know, and that some of my pals were having. Even more annoyingly.
Of course.
So after she and I divorced, which was 4 years down the road, 4 years was an incredibly long relationship in those days. I mean, my first marriage had lasted a fun-packed 90 days. And so 4 years was really, really going it. But just being sober changed everything for me. And I started going into business. You know, I started doing real estate. And after about 4 years of that, not very successfully, I came to Los Angeles. You know, and I knew not one person in the city, but it feels like the right thing to do. And by now, I'm meditating every morning. I'm developing my intuition. You know, so I get a job doing at a mortgage company, and the first couple fire me. Then they quietly go bust. Meanwhile, I don't have this network that all the other guys have of, you know, people they grew up with and everything. But there's one guy. He was an Israeli guy, and he was tough work. Nobody wanted to work with him. But, you know, I was desperate. I worked with the son of a bitch, and I thought, oh, man, what am I going to charge this guy? You know, he's going to moan at anything, yeah. You know. And right at the end of this conversation, he says, I tell you this, you know, I will not play more than 2 points for this. I thought, 2 points? I was thinking of charging you half a point. I just zipped it and right. charged him 2 points and made like $33,000. I've still got a copy of the check. And the next
wow, fantastic.
About 5 days later, I was dealing with another one of my other clients was an actress. She starred in one of the Almodovar movies, and she was interested in buying these apartments in Hollywood. And she asked me to check it out. And I said, yeah, no, the figures really make a lot of sense. Do it. And she said, you know, I'm not sure I want to be that involved in LA. I live in Spain and all this stuff, or Italy, or wherever the hell it was she lived. So, you know, I just gotten this big check. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and I thought, why don't I do the deal? So I called her up and I said, look, if you're not going to do it, do you mind if I do it? And she said, no, go ahead. So it was 1993. Californian real estate was in free fall. The legend was nothing east of La Brea would ever be worth anything again. We just had the riots, the floods, the fires. You know, it was like, what's next? Locusts? And wow. And everybody was getting out of real estate, you know, and the bank owned this property. And I bought it off the bank, you know, and with just enough money from what the Israeli guy had basically given me.
Right, given you. Yeah.
And then 6 months later, I leveraged that and took cash out and bought another place, you know. And in those days, you know, it was easy dock. So, you know, you could work the market. You know, nobody asked too many questions. And, you know, and that was how it was back then. You know, so I ended up leveraging properties. And I just knew it was the bottom of the market. Everybody else was going one way. They were all getting out. And I always think that if you do the opposite of what everybody else does, you're probably going to be okay.
Boom. There's the word. Do the opposite. Absolutely. Well done. Yeah, that's a great story. I love that story. And, of course, it's paid off, clearly.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, all the properties I bought back in 93 are all worth, you know, 10 times what I paid for them, you know, now.
Yeah, fantastic.
But you know, it's like if you go into the market when everybody else is selling, you know, whether it's in stocks or property, you know, and I'll say that I'm lucky. I'm not taking, you know, credit for it. It was, you know, the voice of intuition in these situations, you know, and then things change again. You know, I just kind of figured when I came over here that, you know, the band was dead. You know, it had happened. It was gone. But when I was in in England in like 99, came back to see my family. I bumped into Ricky. Well, Ricky and I got together. He's the drummer from the Automatics. He went on to play in Sham 69. Yeah. And anyway, he gave me a bunch of pictures and things because I'd never kept anything. You know, my life back then was complete chaos. So I had my personal assistant just put them up on a website. And then I started getting emails from little boys all over the world, mostly little boys, you know, from Bavaria and Tonga, you know, saying your record changed my life. You know, all this was coming just at a time when I knew that I could be reaching out and really killing it in real estate. You know, I was looking at offices, you know, in Beverly Hills. I was thinking about, you know, going public with my, you know, pushing the company and taking on more agents and all that. And, you know, I had a full-time personal assistant and, you know, so anyway, I have the assistant at this point doing automatic stuff. So, you know, off we're going. Then I get a message from this boy in Japan, a guy called Fifi. And Fifi and his brother Fink, they have a Japanese punk band that's really pretty good, actually. And they said, you know, I'd like to introduce you to Toshio Ijima at Bass Records. So through Fifi and Fink, I met Toshio, and Toshio said, "Well, you know, let's release, you know, all the unreleased automatic stuff, most of which had never been heard. I mean, just the single came out, you know, went to number one in the alternative charts, and you know, it should have been the beginning of something, but actually, it ended up being the end of something because, you know, the guy at Island got fired, and a new broom sweeps clean, and so you don't want to make your predecessor look like a genius by breaking all his acts. So, you know, you dump him." And, you know, a tough lesson to learn at 26 when, you know,
of course,
all the people who are lining up to kiss your ass one week are crossing the road to avoid you the next week. You know, tough lesson at 26. So anyway, he says, so, you know, and at the, so I, yeah, okay, all right. And I have like an ancient test pressing from which Toshio takes the tracks and he lovingly eliminates every pop and crack, and we release it. And as we're going out, said, "Well, are you coming over to perform and support it
and promote the record?" Yeah.
I don't think so. You know, I mean, I literally had not heard any of these songs in 30 years. I mean, I hadn't been singing them in, I hadn't sung them in the shower, you know. But that weekend, my wife was writing a piece for Architectural Digest on Palm Springs modernism, and they lent us a Corvette, a beautiful Corvette. We drove to Palm Springs, you know, to write about modernism and the Elvis House and Frey, you know, just all the great modernist architects. And so we crank up. Finally, I'd got a CD of it. So, you know, it's the first time I've heard it in 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're going down the 10 in this, you know, tits up Corvette, and with the automatics blasting out. And, you know, my wife saying, "Wow, I had no idea you were good." And, you know, I thought, well, I didn't really either, but it does seem to have, you know, I said, "But I'm not going to Japan." She said, "Oh, yeah, you're going to Japan." I said, "Why?" She said, because I want to go. At the time that I was, strutting the boards at the Marquee, my wife was married to her first husband, Count Pancho Drahoyoski, and he was arranging the biggest deal in the world at the time between the Japanese government and the Mexican government. He was a Latin American specialist. Guess who lost their shirt on that one? But so she was a little barefoot countessa in Tokyo in like 1976 or something. And, you know, her mentor was a guy called Donald Ritchie, who became a national treasure in Japan. He wrote extensively about Japanese culture post-war to the Americans. He was responsible for drawing Kurosawa to the attention of the West. He was a personal friend of Mishima, and he wrote a wonderful several wonderful books, but the most the best known of which is The Inland Sea by Donald Ritchie. So she wanted to see Donald. She wanted to see her old pals. That's why we went to Japan.
You know? Wow.
And I just didn't know if I still had it. You know, I got there. I was terribly jet lagged. I rehearsed with these Japanese boys, you know, who played just like the record, which was, you know, bad news for me, because the only time I ever did it like the record was on the when we recorded the record, you know. So I had to learn to standardize things a bit. And off we went on, you know, off we went on this tour. And, you know, to begin with, I just kind of the first night I just froze. You know, I came out and then I heard, you know, the riff to When the Tanks Roll Over Poland Again, you know, somewhere over there, and just suddenly, all the muscle memory, you know, of having toured with it and performed with it, it all just came out. You just become this marionette. This big engine starts up behind you, and you're drawn along by it. And we went out and we did all these tours, and it was just like it was in the Marquee in like 77, 78. It was an amazing tour, and you know, I mean, normally you go to I hadn't done any, but you know, I'd been to friends' things, punk reunions, and it's all the same guys as were there, you know, 30, 40 years ago, you know, just a whole lot more of them with a whole lot less hair.
Of course, And how do you feel when you think that? When you think that you've gone through this transition of finding a new motive in life in property and acquisition and real estate, and you're doing well, and you've got your personal assistant, and you've got all this stuff going on, which makes you think, great, I'm pleased with what I'm achieving here, and then you experience that moment in Japan when the muscle memory kicks in and all of that feeling that you've been missing for all those years. How do you describe your feeling at that point in time?
Well, you know, I mean, I was torn because I was killing it, and it was a different criteria. You're doing it for money, but, you know, it's nice to win. And, you know, whenever I'd get a big check or something, you know, I'd always buy myself something, you know, as a reward. So, you know, I mean, I had a collection of art and guitars, but somehow, you know, seeing a new generation of kids reacting to the music made me realize that it wasn't just a timepiece, you know, something that belonged in the 1970s and had no life outside of that. So then I started, you know, when I got back, I started, instead of rewarding myself with more stuff, you know, I started going into the studio and I met up with this guy, Jim Wirt, who produced the first Fiona Apple single and Hoobastank and Incubus and all these. And we, you know, started working together and it was fun. And then slowly over the next few years, what happened is real estate and making money became less important to me. And I still had some pretty good years, you know. But, you know, now I don't really do it at all. I mean, I manage the properties that I own, but it's all about writing. Yeah, plus also somewhere in there, you know, I had a few cancer surgeries, which also make you think about what's important in life.
Of course, yeah. You know? Yeah.
I mean, the world doesn't need another real estate fat cat, you know. but a good song is, you know, is something. I'm not sure what, but it somehow on some level somewhere in me, it feels important to do it. So the game changes. I mean, one time it was grow up, be responsible, make some cold hard cash, and then, you know, honor yourself and what you're actually meant to do. So I must say, I'm having a great time right now. I'm at a good
point. And that comes back to purpose, right, David? It's you know, if it's soulless, yeah, you have to earn a living, you have to survive, you have to thrive to the extent you can, but it always comes back down to what you love. And the key is, do we always, you know, understand what it is we love? Do we go on this aimless journey of jumping from step to step? Do we ever actually sit down and think, what is it that's going to make me truly happy? And that's why I asked you the question about how you felt, because, and you've said it yourself, suddenly, you know, the real estate became less important because you were suddenly doing something that you truly, truly loved. And it clearly has an impact on how you feel.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true, you know, and things change, people change. If you've got the same interests in the same way 40 years later, you've got to ask yourself what you've done with the last 40 years. You know, I mean, I write differently, different kinds of songs, you know, I look at the world differently, you know, and... But I'm really kind of fortunate, I think, where I am right now, because I look at, you know, I got sent to the showers early, and taken off the bench, and I look at some of the guys who hung on. You know, I wouldn't want to be out there having to make, having to play 200 nights a year. Traveling all over the place, carrying your own amp. It looks a lot like hard work. You know, I'd much rather do it on my own terms when the hell I feel like it.
Of course.
And I'm in that fortunate position. Yeah, yeah. So,
fantastic. So looking back over, that's incredible stories. I mean, looking back over your career, the last 40 years and all the things you've just been talking about, What would you say if you had to try and select one thing? What is the one thing you would suggest you were most grateful for?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. You know, because not all the decisions that I have described are active decisions. Some of them have been passive. It's been the way it works out. You know, and I think you have to be okay with, you know, you get what you get, you know, and you got to be okay with that. So that's the message.
Brilliant. And of course, it's right. Yeah, it's about a no regret strategy, isn't it? And, you know, you find your way through life and it's the ability to understand that, as you say, passive decisions or active decisions, your life is what it is and it's what you make it to be, I guess. So
it's the path.
Of course, it is the path, yeah. And the path is, I'm a great believer in you set the path. People have said to me quite frequently, I do a lot of stuff on what I think the future is going to be in terms of technology. And people say to me, so come on, Jeff, you've got a real good thought process on it. What's the future? You know, tell me about the future. What's the future going to be? And I say it's the easiest question you've ever asked me, because my answer is, what do you want it to be? Because the future will be whatever you choose it to be, because that's the decisions you make in life. So if you can imagine, you know, your incredible story and your experiences, and of course, we've only scratched the surface. I mean, we could go on for hours, especially on what I know about you, David. But if there was one message that you would like to give, you know, the audience listening to this podcast, based upon your knowledge, your experiences, your active and your passive decisions, what single message would you think that you would love to pass out?
I think it would be this. Don't be afraid to screw up. It's okay to screw up. That's how you learn. Yeah. And you don't need to apologize for screwing up. It's part of the path. So screw the hell on up. That's my message. That's the t-shirt.
Boom, 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 and boom. And our motto is exactly that. You do not learn until you fail. And people need to be less concerned about the fear of failure.
If you have the capacity to learn from your mistakes. When I got sober and started looking at myself, I didn't have to hurt for free anymore, you know, because I could learn from my mistakes. You know, when I was a kid and I was stumbling around, I'd do something dumb and, oh man, that didn't work out well. And next time it come around, I'd do it again because I hadn't learned the lesson, you know. And when you don't do that, you're a victim of a cold and a hostile world. And, you know, a victim doesn't have a full range of options. You know, if you're a victim, what do you get to do? You get to sit there and get peed on from a great height. That's it. That's your choice. When you say, mm-hmm. I did this to me, you learn. When you say, I did this to me, you can do something different the next time. And all of a sudden, you've taken your power back.
Mm-hmm.
You're not a victim anymore. So the capacity to self-monitor, you know, screw up, learn your lessons, don't hurt for free.
Great saying. Love it to death. Absolutely brilliant. And again, completely on my train of thought on life as well as business. So that's fantastic. Anyway, listen, David, thank you so much for sharing your incredible stories. It's been an absolute pleasure to have your company for the last half an hour. And it's been inspirational. And of course, you've absolutely nailed it when it comes to the purpose of the podcast, which is doing the opposite, business disruptors. You took it to the stratosphere. So I look forward to catching up again, David. Best of success for the future. And of course, we will stay in touch. So thank you very much indeed, David.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been fun.